So the panel I was getting together is Leanne from Talkeetna. Brian's kind of our Fairbanks dude. And then Rob is going to be our lodge representative. And he's also flying for Island Air Express, which I just found out. And they're an awesome company based in Klawick, which is down near Ketchikan. But he's also a plane in Scottsdale, Arizona, where he's flying right now, which that's rough duty to do your winters in Scottsdale.
It's rough.
Yeah.
I got sunburned today.
Oh. Feel bad for you, Rob.
Yeah.
Cool. So the focus of this discussion was going to be sort of building on what Brian and I talked about in December, but maybe in a more rational manner. I think I was still a little emotional in December after the accident at Hagland. And we don't want to talk about accidents in particular. We can talk about some trends with Hagland's. I think that's going to lead the trend in Alaska. And then I also want to touch on seasonal jobs that are coming up and places that may be hiring and, you know, possibly what to look for in a seasonal operator. And I think you guys are really good for kind of for that discussion. And in terms of trends in aviation, I don't know if much has changed in Talkeetna. Seems like it's pretty steady state.
Yeah, steady state.
But they were, when I was flying there, they were pretty, it was pretty by the book. And, I mean, it was, the feds have a pretty, they come down to Talkeetna quite a bit. So there wasn't much, they were pretty, most of the operations are pretty tight in Talkeetna. But kind of along those lines, I am curious about who might be hiring in Talkeetna this year. I know you were saying TAT is probably booked up for this year. Is K2 or anyone else looking that you know of?
Talkeetna Air Taxi is likely to hire 1-2 more pilots based on sort of hearing back from a few returning pilots. They've already hired 2 pilots this year, but they're looking to potentially hire 1 or 2 more. And then
okay.
K2, I would imagine, would be looking to hire probably 1 to 3 pilots this year.
You've been there for years. I know you just started flying for Above Alaska last year, but you've been in Talkeetna for, I mean, since time immemorial.
9 years, yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen a recent trend in recent? It seems like with the Western Alaskan jobs and a lot of aviation jobs in general, there's been a hiring increase, not a massive influx, but a slow, steady, just kind of hiring trend. In Talkeetna, does it seem like outfits are bringing on more pilots in the summer, more new pilots? Or not so much?
It's a very gradual increase as they add more aircraft to their fleet, but just very gradual.
Okay, and everybody's starting to go more and more turbine, seems like.
Yes, turbine time would be really good, but if you can fly 185, you can get hired.
Excellent. And helicopters. TAT's got a helicopter. Do you think that's going to be a trend?
It's a trend that we're waiting to see. We're waiting to see how that all shakes out. I think all the air taxis are waiting to see how the helicopter thing shakes out.
Cool. Meanwhile, everybody's having fun flying it.
Yes. Meanwhile, yeah, everybody is having a lot of fun flying it.
Danielle and Will, especially.
Yes, I think Paul actually bought it for Danielle and Will.
That was a good investment.
Yeah.
They'll be around forever now. They're good people to keep around.
Yeah.
And Leanne, what sort of flights are you doing yourself?
Well, I'm a brand new commercial pilot, so I was flight instructing last year, and I'm going to be the 135 pilot for single pilot float plane operation.
Okay.
That's going to be a float plane.
Float planes,
so
yeah.
I didn't know the 185 was on floats. Ah, awesome.
Yes.
What about the other flight school? What's the other one up at the lake? I can't think of its name.
Oh, goodness, that would be Don Lee of Alaska Floats and Skis.
Yeah, do you know if they're looking for flight instructors through the summer, or are they pretty well set as well?
I would imagine they're looking for one flight instructor, as is our company. So that would be, you know, entry-level flight instruction job as long as someone has their commercial seaplane rating. And then,
seaplane and
Yeah, exactly. And so they just hired 2 CF5s to replace some longtime CFIs that they had. And the turnover is because those CFIs were going back to school, so it wasn't like an employment issue. It's just sort of natural turnover.
Right. That happens at flight schools more than air taxis, I think.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I didn't know the 185 was going to be on a float. That'll be fun.
It's a 180, so it's kind of a dog.
Yeah, I don't know. A friend of ours, Eric Z, used to fly a 180 up to a lot of off-airport work around COTS, and he said as long as you didn't overload it, it was just as good as the 185. So.
Right, but Hunter's always they always want 1.1 loads instead of 1.0 loads, right?
You just check it out. I know you're harsh. I watch you with my clients at Aconcagua. Don't take that. That's not going. You don't need two pairs of gloves.
We'll see.
You'd be like, you got two moose. You can only take one.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, it's and Matt, if you got any questions, feel free to pop in and ask something. If not, I'm just going to keep running at the stuff that I'm interested in.
Other than Matt, is everyone else someone that Aiden knows, or do we have any other members on here?
My name's Mike.
Hi, Mike. Where are you from?
Well, I'm from Maine, really.
Cool. You get a lot of float flying there.
Well, not as much as there used to be. The aviation economy in Maine is kind of on its butt. There's one fellow on Moosehead Lake who does a lot of rides. There used to be a lot of fire patrols, and there used to be a lot of 135, but not so much anymore because they've blown so many roads into the woods with the logging. So there's just not as much traditional full plane flying as there used to be.
I heard a few years ago, and I could be wrong about this, that there were some islands out there, and the float operation air taxi was shutting down, and so the residents actually bought the air taxi. I don't know if that was true or if it's still around, something I need to dig into, but it always struck me as an interesting way to solve the problem of the air taxis not having quite enough business and shutting down, so the residents said, well.
Well, isn't that sort of what happened with the island out there in Colac?
Yeah, well, actually, and Rob's actually flying for those guys. You probably missed the intro, but we've got Rob on here who flies for a company called Island Air Express, which is out of Klawik, and they run Garrett-powered caravans on amphibs or straight wheels, and they do a lot of IFR work, too, but it's a pretty good operation.
Aren't the principals a lodge owner?
It's based on a lodge. Yeah, it's a lodge that then got a plane and just started building it up from there. And I interviewed the chief pilot, Pat Goodrich, I think it was last year or year before last, and he's an awesome guy. They're a pretty good operation. I think Rob would agree with me on that. So, anyway, Rob, when you were up there, what do you see with Island Air Express?
Yeah, it's an interesting story because the lodge owner, he bought the caravan because he was having a problem with the Beaver air taxis really providing good enough service. And he said, well, why don't I just do my own in-house transportation? And it turned out that the villagers, you know, the residents of Glock were saying, well, we could use this to go Ketchikan IFR. And now their business is booming. They're making a ton of money. They've taken a ton of business away from the local Beaver straight float people. And so the caravan that I'm at down here in Scottsdale is their third airplane they've purchased this year. So they're running the two Garrett engines on wheels full-time in winter, and this one's a PT6 that they thought, well, we'll use the less horsepower, less battery usage to burn what we're doing in Scottsdale where we can't do a lot of GPU starts. Because one of the owners, there are two owners, one's up there in Alaska full-time, one is down here, a longtime resident of Scottsdale, and he wanted to have this winter operation with an airplane down here. So this airplane doesn't make any money right now down here. He's still trying to build up the business. But it'll earn its pay in Alaska during the busy summer lodge season. So I don't know if he'll continue this operation down here, if he'll make it a success and they'll continue on. I think that's maybe the weirdness of the winter float or amphib operations, is that you just don't know how it's going to go. I've got another friend, Ayn Roberts, who some of you may know, and she's doing an amphib caravan operation down in Puerto Rico. same kind of story with this weird New York company where they're trying it out, but they're not really making money this year. So as far as, like, the stability of winter float jobs, that's the weird thing is I have no idea if I'll be back next year. You just don't know. So the Alaska summertime float thing is still the mainstay of the economic operation for me, like my main money earning time of year. But those guys in Flowalk, at least now I'm in with them, and if my lodge job falls apart, then I've got a good backup to be working with these guys because now I'm 135 with them, Island Air Express, to be working with them with our three caravans. So they've got a model that's working, and it's a new and different model than the original, you know, the old-time, long-time Beaver on floats. That's how we're going to do it. Everybody laughed at these guys bringing a caravan on Amphib into Klawak, Ketchikan area, and they're making money with it. They just got contracts this year to do medevac and mail. It just came on within the last 2 to 3 months, and they're making bank. So who knows where they could go. And they're always in need of good, skilled pilots. They just hired an IFR pilot for the winter up there, and they need to mix the pilots. So they need somebody who can do amphibs in the summer, fly wheels, fly IFR, all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah, and Mike, I cheated. I looked you up on the network. You've got a ton of time. I'm sure if you're interested, they'd be interested.
I spent one season with a fire service out of Fairbanks, and I worked in the Iliamna Lake Clark area as well.
Oh, yeah. Yep, I know that area pretty well. And I see that you flew a Norseman. I'm totally jealous.
Oh, well, that was a long time ago. I don't think there are any left on the U.S. Registry. I'm not sure. So maybe in museums.
I think there might be some with the museums, like flying museums, but that's about, I think that would be about it.
Royal Coachman up in the Woodtickchick area was looking for a pilot for July and August only. And
okay.
I talked with Scott. I don't remember his last name, but I think he's like the ops guy there. And I ended up turning him down for a number of reasons, and then the ad that he had reappeared, so I guess he doesn't have anybody yet for that. He has a full-time pilot who has a Super Cub that does a contract spotting fish for somebody, one of the government organizations, and the guy does this every summer, and they have to backfill the job, so somebody might, you know, if you're interested. It sounded good. They were going to pay round-trip airfare from the lower 48. They were going to pay $3,500 a week while you were in training, $3,500 a month while you're in training, and $7,000 a month plus tips. They said tips ran around $650 a week.
That's not bad at all. I also cheated. Look, you're flying for Global Flight Relief, and probably bring that up.
Yeah,
I know Matt.
I just came back from Uganda, where it was a little unstable. South Sudan blew up while I was over there, and Central African Republic's unstable, and Democratic Republic of the Congo's unstable, and they were throwing grenades at each other in Rwanda. So it was an interesting, two-month contract.
Yeah, I flew in the Congo for a while, and I was just kind of watching the news recently with Congo and Rwanda, and there's issues with the UN's been going after the rebels in the Congo, but they've been going after mainly the Rwandan-sponsored rebels. And the Rwandans are pissed off at the Congolese and the UN because they are not going after the Rwandans who fled Rwanda because they perpetrated the genocide. And they're still in the Congo, and they have little armed groups. And the Congolese haven't gone after them quite as hard, and that's caused some issues.
Well, some of the Congolese have been running across the border into Uganda, too, and there was some issues there, and then there was what they called it a coup. I don't think it started off as a coup in South Sudan, and then that was the 15th of December, and then by the 23rd of January, supposedly they had a ceasefire going. And Central African Republic, where it's religious as opposed to South Sudan, where it's tribal, and the CAR, the Prime Minister and the President both resigned, and mayor of the largest of the capital ended up becoming the new president, happens to be a woman. But that was all Muslim and Christian militias fighting back and forth, and South Sudan was members of the two largest tribes, including a deposed former vice president. So it was all the SU-30s in Entebbe were on hot alert with rockets and guns, and three U.S. CB-22 Ospreys got shot up. Four Americans were wounded. One guy lost a leg. It was quite a mess for a while.
Yeah, that would it also fit with. I was looking at a job with AAR flying a COS out of Entebbe.
AAR got the contract from Evergreen. Evergreen protested the award, and AAR couldn't get the equipment and people in place quickly enough. So Evergreen's got the contract at least through the end of March, and has protested the award. Apparently, AAR's bid was pretty darn low, and there was some question that they would get halfway through it and say, "No, we need more money." So I don't know what's going to happen there. I was in Melbourne, Florida the other day, where a lot of the AAR equipment is too, and there was a CASA there and a couple of Dash 8s, and
That would explain. Didn't Ericsson Skycrane buy Evergreen?
That's my understanding, yeah. I have no first-hand knowledge on it.
Okay, yeah, I think they did that last May. So, yeah, I was going to go swing by their office in Oregon and talk to them just to see what they're up to. It seems like Ericsson is kind of taken off here. Cool. So Global Flight Relief pulled out of Uganda is kind of what happened, sounds like, with the instability.
No, they actually, what they did is Somebody moved their family over there, so they're not doing as much short-term contract. One of the guys went over for 6 months with his wife and kids.
Got it.
So they're saving a lot of money on airfares, which could run anywhere from roughly $2,000 to $3,500 each time. So,
yeah, yep. What were you flying for? I'm just looking at their website now, too.
Pilatus PC-12 that was set up for Medevac.
Okay, nice. Yeah, that'd be a good plane. That'd be a good business. I didn't see that on their website. I saw the caravan. Caravans, it's sometimes hard to get real high over the hills there.
I mean, the field elevation in Entebbe is 3870, and, they run some pretty warm density altitudes, and the hills go up as you go over towards Lake Albert and up towards South Sudan and CIR. So,
yeah.
Everything below 13 tends to be the caravans. It's pretty wild over there. I mean, there's some operations in above 180 that don't have clearances, and that's pretty much the altitude structure from 13 to 29 or 30 for the ISR birds, the Pilatuses and the Geese King Airs and 200s and 350s, and then the CASAs and the caravans are down low, and then the jets are up higher. So it's pretty weird.
Yeah, that's when I was in the Congo, it was I think maybe even less organized. Everybody was just everywhere. Of course, I was in a caravan.
Oh, so there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of self-announced on 26.9.
So. Yep. And that sounds about right. I was wondering how it was kind of blowing up and following the news about what was going on. I just wasn't sure how that was affecting. You never really know what the effect, what's really going on when you're sitting over here reading the news.
Obama's sent special forces over there. It's not, there's no secret there. All you have to do is go on Google and search around a little bit, and you can find out that's going on over there. And they're chasing Joseph Kony around, who's displaced probably 750,000 people and put about 60,000 kids under the age of 16 and given them guns and told them to go out and shoot people. So he's an international war criminal, according to The Hague, and so they're still chasing him around, and he's in a really tough area. But it's interesting work, and some of the money's excellent. Some of it's not as good.
That sounds about right. That's what a friend of mine was flying in Afghanistan. And as that shut down, he said everything's been moving to Africa. you know, they cut all the pay for the Afghan pilots or the pilots flying in Afghanistan, but a lot of the stuff moved into Somalia, Uganda. I've been to Nairobi recently. I didn't see a whole lot extra there, but Nairobi's got its own issues. Djibouti, I think there's stuff flying around Djibouti nowadays, too, because I hear them when I fly overhead.
Yeah, we had one of our medevacs into Djibouti. There was an outfit in Nairobi that was looking for a caravan Pilatus Beach 1900 person, and I don't know much about them, but they were looking. There are a couple of expats flying for Kampala Executive Aviation, a caravan, and another PC-12. It's a real early PC-12, and it's spent some time sitting doing nothing and not getting any maintenance, so it's kind of a great place. It's a money sink, maintenance-wise, probably, but there are some expats working locally right there, and I think for Air Serv as well.
Oh, Air Serv is still there. Huh, that's what I was flying for in the Congo.
Air Serv.
Yeah, Air Serv. Yep.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah, they're still in Tibi.
Okay, that's good to hear they're still around. Yeah, when I was in Afghanistan, I flew with PakTek, which was kind of, Air Serv was in Afghanistan too, but PakTek kind of, I think that they just changed the name and changed some of the organization a bit. But
it's a little off subject, but what happened with your visa?
Oh, yeah, that was a, I got issued a single entry visa for Tajikistan. And when I got my visa back from the passport agency, it was all written in Tajik, so I didn't know that. And the passport agency didn't say anything. So, you know, we landed in Dushanbe, and then we went into Afghanistan through Tajikistan. Then when we were trying to get back into Tajikistan to go back to Dushanbe and leave, I'd already been stamped out. So the captain was kind of looking for something anyways. From what I hear, usually the Tajiks are pretty open to, you know, some kind of bribe, but he was not interested in the bribe. He wanted to cause a hassle, so, and, you know, my visa wasn't proper.
Wow.
So he kicked me back into Afghanistan that was interesting.
I can't wait to hear the story in full.
What's that?
I can't wait to hear your story in full. You've promised me.
Yeah, it's not quite as interesting as it. Like I said, everything worked out, so it actually wasn't. The good stories are the ones where everything goes wrong. But I'm happy it worked out. Well, I'll have to look into global flight relief a little bit more. I've been looking at them; they look pretty interesting. Sounds like it. I was hoping to do a flight over to
Global Flight Relief or Relief?
Relief. R-E-L-I-E-F.
Okay.
Yeah, and Mike, do you know what they look for? And I mean, we're totally off subject of Alaska here, but this kind of stuff I've been looking for. Do you know, are they hire people for the right seat, lower time people, or do they want pretty experienced pilots?
They're using locals over there for right seat when they need to. One of the contracts requires two pilots if there are Americans on board, and then doesn't stipulate if there are locals. And all the medevacs I ended up doing in the 65 days I was there were not Americans. They were some other nationality. So they were looking for an experienced PC-12 guy when I stumbled on them and had some time to go play. So right now the PC-12 is crewed for at least the next roughly 5 months unless something changes over there. Kampala Executive Aviation, that has one of the contracts over there and also has caravans, three of them, occasionally hires and supposedly is going to be in some expansion mode. And those are all rumors. There's some pretty wild rumors flying around over there.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've got a friend who he's an aircraft salesman, basically. I mean, that's a simple way of putting it, but he's doing a tour through Africa in May and June. And I was really hoping to go over with him and hit all, he's going to hit, you know, 5 or 6 countries. I was going to dig into a lot, but I think I'm going to be up guiding on Denali, so I'm going to miss that trip. But it does sound like interesting stuff's happening there. And I know Kenya, it's hard to get hired if you're not a Kenyan. That's pretty tough, but
you've got, well, and they want you. Yeah. They want you. Most of them seem to want you to convert your license at your expense rather than at theirs. But hard to. Maybe that's negotiable.
Yeah, I think it depends how badly they need you and
exactly
what your experience is. But a lot of the people, as I walked around Wilson there and talked to a whole bunch of people, and they're all like, yeah, they really like people with a Kenyan citizenship. That's hard to do.
There is a caravan position that's based out of Oboe, which is in the extreme southeast corner of CAR, and they want you to live on site, and the it's pretty remote and pretty austere. And the aircraft, I think, is working for Invisible Children. And you know, you could one of the guys stayed over there 6 months, and he just flew his butt off because he never said no. And he put 70 hours on the airplane one time in 15 days. It'd be a good time builder, and it's you know, it's supporting a worthy cause.
Yeah, it's a good time, but it's also, you don't want to go over there if you do low time, if you're, it sounds like you're kind of on your own making it.
Oh, you are, and there are only some places don't have fuel, and you know, but it's, you know, if you're a decent caravan pilot, you do fine.
Yeah, that's well. Actually, the Nepalese guys I worked with are looking for a caravan driver over in Nepal right now. They were awesome to work for.
Is that Goma Air?
Yeah, that's Goma Air. I know, it's funny that it's Goma Air, and I lived in Goma when I was in the Congo. I always get the two confused. But yeah, the Goma Air guys were awesome. I really liked them. But yeah, they're looking. That's a job you need to be a. You don't have to be, but you should be a pretty good caravan driver / bush pilot type person.
Mm.
Not bush pilot, but those trips are pretty horrendous.
Yeah, I saw some of those videos you were showing me on your computer. With a caravan landing on a short strip. Pretty incredible.
Yeah, they're 1,400-foot strips at, you know, 8,500-foot field elevation, and it's pretty warm over there, even in the winter. Yeah, it was fun. Anyway, let's get the... yeah, Mike, if you think of anything else, just pop in there. If you think of anything good about Africa, pop in, too. I'm always... I may just call you up later on the time and talk to you about Africa. That's
we should probably at some point do a call on Africa.
Absolutely. I was hoping to. We've got Ezra is up in, his friend of Travis's, who's flying in Alaska now for Alaska Air Taxi. And he flew in Tanzania for 10 years for, I think it's called Flying Doctor Service.
Yeah, they're all over the place over there. Doctors Without Borders.
No. He was for a very small thing. I think it's called Flying Doctor Service. And the pilots actually act as medics. I mean, they're administering shots and all kinds of it. I've looked at Travis knew the guy real well, the guy who runs it, and it's kind of a volunteer thing, from what I understand. I'll have to take it that I'm going to have to talk to Ezra when I get up to Alaska in April. I think you've got some good stories, but I'd love to talk to you more about Africa, too. And sounds like Global Flight Relief is a company I might want to talk to, see what they've got going on. They sound interesting. So,
I can send you some contact information.
Oh, that'd be awesome. That would be awesome. I also noticed you're a PGA and a skydiver.
Oh, that came with the job a long time ago.
PGAs are awesome. There's a PGA up on a... he's a ranger on Denali. He's a little excitable.
Yeah, a lot of the guys at Kulis summoned at Denali while they were up there on their tours. I'm an old guy, so it was a little easier to be a PJ 40 years ago than it is now. But because they didn't they didn't send us to Halo school, and they didn't do the weapons training they do now, but of course the job changed too. So although the guys in Alaska do the same job that we did 40 years ago, it's rescue. I saw a lodge beaver go down in the Iliamna area when I was up there one summer, and ended up being a job mission for the guys out of Anchorage. And then they brought a Black Hawk in, and they ended up, it was when Arrow was running Convairs, and one guy went back on the Convair, and two guys went back in the 130, and there were three non-survivors. So it was an interesting scenario.
Huh. That sounds pretty cool. I know I always like history of Alaskan aviation. And the further back you go, the more interesting it gets usually.
Well,
that's kind of
that's one of the things that's really neat about Alaska is that it is so steeped in aviation history, and you know, the fact that the road system's non-existent hasn't changed at all in the last 60, 70 years. So the reason for being up there isn't going to change.
That's true. Now that's actually a good segue into kind of part of what we're going to talk about is how the Alaskan aviation culture has changed. And it's part of my take on it is that with GPS approaches everywhere and that Island Air Express, who Rob flies for, they're a good example of, they've got these air-powered caravans and they file IFR a lot of places. And that recent accident in December is definitely causing some changes up there. I think it's kind of accelerating what was going to be a natural process anyways. And it's seems to me, and anyone else can jump in here, that it's getting more, I don't want to say organized, but more formalized, or more like Lower 48.
Is Hagland a Medallion Foundation participant?
They are, yep.
At what level? Are they kind of full-blown? Are they chipping away at it, or where are they in the mix?
Matt may know that. I think they're pretty full blown. I think they're could be wrong in that, but I bet you they're a 5-star. It may not be quite there, but I think they probably are. And I don't want to go too much into my take on the accident, but I know the upper management wasn't encouraging that. They were encouraging a little more formalized flying. And it just wasn't always happening at the level when he got out to the bases.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it seems like. I know I'm kind of hedging my bets there, but until the NTSB figures out what they're going to say, and there are a bunch of rumors kind of going around about it. But I don't. My feeling is that, and I talked to the owner. I mean, straight up, a week before that accident, it's very clear that he didn't want pilots sort of going off the grid. So, and I don't know that Terry was off the grid, but I think that's what people are thinking. So, and with that, Brian, do you have any thoughts on kind of where you think Alaskan aviation's headed? You kind of have some more insight into that.
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head. It's formalized. It's a lot. I mean, like you say, the GPS approaches, they're putting weather out there. The webcams, they're out all over the place. And there's just no, it's not as difficult as the good old days when you and I and Rob were out in St. Mary's and all that stuff, which was a hell of a lot of fun back in the good old days, but certainly not necessary anymore. The only trouble is I see is, like, let's think about where the three of us are familiar with. If you did a trip now, say Bethel to Pilot Station, Mountain Village, back to St. Mary's like we used to do, if you do the GPS approaches into all those places instead of bootlegging in there like the before, it's going to take a lot longer. And that's unfortunately part of the apprehension for people that are used to doing it the old way is that it just takes a lot longer. And not to mention, I mean, can you get, they've got the approaches and they've got the weather, but they haven't got the communication quite set up yet to talk to center. So doing a through clearance into some of those places really takes a big challenge at some times. And will kind of lead people to stray away from that right now. It's got to be a full buy-in, and I think you're right. I assume you must have talked to Jim in Uniclete, and I think the owners are really buying into this, and I think they're going to be willing to accept that additional cost to make it safer and make it easier, because let's just admit it. I can't speak for all the passengers out there, but I think they're embracing this. You know, they're done seeing that stuff being – I can't imagine what they're going through in St. Mary's. I mean, I thought they were probably done with all of that, and now they have to see this again right in their back door.
Literally,
it's good that this technology and stuff, though. I'm sorry, I stepped on you. Go ahead.
Oh, I said literally. The plane was right there. Now, I'm going to play a little devil's advocate because it's hard to make a blanket rule, and if you're doing the flight you just said, you know, St. Mary's, pilot mountain back to St. Mary's, I could make some pretty good arguments that if it's 500, 300, even 300 over, you got the hill rules and all that kind of crap, which I think they're doing away with, but really good biz underneath, I can make good arguments that it's safer to actually not file.
Sure.
I know that's not going to be a popular view right at this moment, but I think... and I wonder how that would be dealt with, because if there's, and are people just not going to fly? They're going to say, well, if there's ice up there, or you know, for whatever reason, it's I'm not going to fly in the clouds, and I've got 30 miles of viz, so I'm just not going to fly. I mean, do you think that would be valid? Do you think it's going that way, or do you think that maybe there may be still room for some of that?
Well, if you've got
that's a
you've got unrestricted visibility under anything, at least, let's say, 500 feet, just so you're pretending that people are being legal all the time. You think that everybody would strive to still do that? I mean, that just makes sense when
right.
it really comes down to it. But when you get into 500-foot ceilings and 2 or 3 miles visibility, I think people are straying away from that because of the technology, the facilities, it's all out there.
It is. I think you're throwing. Yeah, I think you're partly right. I think the other issue is operational control, and so partly what's going to be happening is more of those decisions are going to be taken away from the pilot sitting in St. Mary's. You're going to have someone who's remote saying, "Yeah, don't even bother," and say, "We're looking at the weather on the computer. Don't go." And that's as a pilot, that drives me crazy, because I want to be able to make that decision. But it's how the airlines do it, and it just makes it, it's not always, it's not necessarily the right call, but it's going to generally be the more conservative call.
Yeah.
And it seems like that might be part of what's going to be happening. And ADS-B, as you were mentioning earlier today, that's going to be more prevalent and required. That may affect things as well, although it's kind of out there already.
Yeah, what's required is ADS-B out. So you're going to be able to transmit it, and it'll be all over the place. It's not necessarily that you're going to be able to see it. The buy-in, again, is going to be incumbent on the individual. Are they going to buy the extra equipment to get the ADS-B in as well so they can see? Well, like when TCAS came out, when that became a requirement, of course, everybody could see in, the old fish finder thing. People liked that. Owners bought into it because it was – a way to see things. They like that stuff. Some of these owners are into this fancy G-Wiz stuff. They like it, and it makes things safer. It also allows people to gives them another avenue to get out there, even when the weather or something doesn't seem quite right. But it gives you a little bit of a little feel good as well. And ADS-B will make a big difference. And the interesting thing is just like what we were talking about earlier. Capstone was out in the Bethel and the Yukon Custom Delta in 98. And the funny thing is just in typical fashion, we spearheaded that thing, put it out there, UPS picked up on it, and it's such a good thing that the foreign countries are requiring it already. There was a sunset date not even a month ago you can't go. I think it's China. You can't even go to China without ADS-B, at least ADS-B out. And I think Australia also, and some places in the South Pacific. So the major airlines are already doing this stuff. Why is it always the foreign country? We spearhead these things, and then the foreign countries pick up on it. I think we've lost track of where we need to be.
Well, you go overseas and
our politics,
and you also go overseas, and almost every other country that I've been to, they're much more restrictive on aviation in general, and general aviation they're extremely restrictive on. The UK is pretty open. Some European countries. Africa can be pretty free-for-all-ish, but a lot of countries, especially the ones with more of the stronger central governments, are pretty, they keep pretty tight control on aviation. That's probably partly why. Anything that gives them more ways to look at people, and ADS-B is a way to do that, they're gonna jump on.
It's just plain old cool stuff, just plain and simple.
So, Matt, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still up here.
Yeah, I just got a question. Kind of, you heard what Brian and I were talking about. Is that kind of what you see happening at Hagelin now? Kind of the push is more, file more often. And I'm going to put a few words into your mouth so nobody says that you were saying all this, but file more often.
We're filing a lot more IFR flight plans. And it's funny because Anchorage Center is having to adjust for that themselves. They're so much more work for them to do all over the state we're filing. So,
So that's it all trickles.
That's one thing, but we're allowed to do special VFRs in the caravans now, which is it's kind of reducing the workload for everybody. But still, the intent with the FAA is we need to still file if we can. If the weather is bad, we can file. We should file, and that's the safest thing. We've got the equipment for it, and might as well use it. Caravans and all the twins are IFR capable. The 207s, not so much, but they haven't been filing. But anyways, just along those lines, they're trying to make us more of like an airline.
That seems it. Now, here's a practical question. I know that when all this came down, and it wasn't that long ago, that I'm sure most people were kind of up in arms, saying this is ridiculous. It's not going to work. It's, from pilot perspective, just as I know that's what I would have been doing if I was there. How much has it really affected the day-to-day operation? Has it slowed things down a lot? Are you getting back late for your next flight? I mean, just out of curiosity.
Well, I'm pretty new to Hagelin, so like to compare it to the past, I guess I don't have much to compare it to, but
that's right.
It doesn't seem like it's slowing us down. Maybe just because we're not used to filing IFR as much, and so it's kind of more awkward to plan and file, and it always is a lot more work to do an IFR flight than it is a VFR flight. So, if we could go VFR, we're gonna definitely try to do that over anything, but that just takes a look. Think ahead a little bit and start planning earlier, and so you can get out still on time and everything.
Cool. All right. So that's my guess is a year from now, it's just going to be normal. It's going to be people aren't
just a little speed bump.
That's what you do.
I think it's great. I think, it's for safety, having to go IFR is great. I mean, we're in contact with Center. There's more people out here flying nowadays. It seems like if we can go IFR, more people should be on board with that. And so maybe we're starting something for other carriers too. I know for sure, the other companies are having a little bit more oversight, just like we are now. The FAA is also looking at other companies a little closer, like Grant and Bering Air, and so they're gonna be, changing their ways also.
I heard that through the grapevine. That was I know there was some discussion at one point of shutting the whole thing down after accidents. I'll do that with us and the airline up there. But I know that one of the comments by one of the FAA people was along the lines of, hey, we're not going to shut you down, so we'll just open up a whole new can of worms. We'd much rather just make sure that you guys are operating in a safer fashion. You know, we can do something about this, whereas if we shut you down, we're going to have every, you know, all these other operators are going to start expanding like crazy, and it's going to be a extremely unsafe free-for-all. So,
yeah.
I think they said they were looking for Hagelin to kind of lead the way in the way they think aviation is going to last.
Yeah, exactly.
So now to juxtaposition all that, Rob, with the lodge work, do you expect any of this to affect you at a lodge much?
Can you ask that again, Aiden? I missed that.
Do you have another glass of wine?
Hey, I'm on a frozen yogurt now. I'm sobering up.
I was just going to say, since you're flying for lodges, and you know, with all these trends towards filing IFR, but you're flying a Beaver on floats. Do you see any of these new requirements or these new, not even requirements, the new kind of culture that the FAA is trying to develop out, and certainly in Western Alaska, do you expect that to really impact the lodge work all that much?
Not a bit, and that's why I love it, because it'll forever be out of their scope. It's Part 91. They don't care unless it's a high-profile person that dies like Ted Stevens. It's always going to be the same because the work is always going to be the same. And the FAA doesn't really care that much. If you kill a bunch of people, yes. But I got to tell you, I love flying 91. And, you know, 135, it's okay for the operation doing right here, but I don't really like all the stress of it. So the pay is getting much better at the lodges. Some big money is starting to come into the thing. I mean, I think the old pattern is Ron Hayes and, you know, Ray Loesche. These guys, tight-fisted, trying to run these lodges. It's not like that anymore. The big corporations are coming in. So we just got bought out by Bristol Bay Corporation. They have no argument against our salaries. It's gone almost obscene what they're paying us now. So, like, we'll bring in – so, we have three Beavers, three pilots. We may need another pilot maybe this year, maybe next year. I think we're starting out at $9,000, $9,500, somewhere there. We made over – almost 12,000 in tips last year. So the amount you can make in about 3.5 weeks is obscene, and I don't have to take a check ride. I fly into Anchorage, I hop in my Beaver, I start it up, maybe I do three landings, and then I'm off out to, Dillingham, and we're working. So there's no check rides, there's no ground school, there's no bullshit, there's nothing during the season. You just do your job, you do a good job flying the airplane. And the other side of it is, you know, when we're looking for a pilot, it's not about a resume. It's not so much about experience. It's really about who you are as a person and who you know and how you're going to get along with the crew. And I interviewed a guy to come on work for us, and he's like, well, they want me to come to Penn to do an interview. And I said, well, you got a recommendation from Willie Fulton. You've worked at Andrew Airways on Kodiak for 2 years. I don't need to know anything more. That's all I need to know to hire you. You're good. He's like, so can I bring my skis? I'm like, yeah, bring your skis. So our whole interview was basically skiing Mount Bachelor for 2 days and talking about how much – my main question for him was, how much do you not like flying? Because when you work lodge work, you have to be okay sitting on your ass for 7 hours a day doing nothing and be burned out on air taxi work and not want to talk about flying. I don't want to talk about flying when I'm working. So it's almost a totally different culture. Like, I don't want an aviation buff who wants to talk about flying all day. I want somebody who wants to go wakeboarding and fishing and hang out and shoot birds and do all that crap. So it's kind of a different culture. And now I'm getting off the topic of aviation, but it's a job that allows me to be in aviation and love it because I don't have to really deal with all that 135 bullshit.
Well, and that's if you're flying too much, you kind of burn out. I mean, it's not
honestly, my goal in aviation right now at this point is to maximize my per hour pay per flight hour. So I want to fly less and earn more for that.
But and everyone who doesn't know Rob, keep in mind he's the guy who moved to Maui and made. When did you sell kite surfing material for a couple seasons?
Yeah, so I'm all about my free time. I love flying. I mean, I feel lucky that this little niche of float flying has kind of afforded me this life, but it's a scary thing, too, because you think, well, man, if I don't have this, I'm not qualified for anything in life. My English degree isn't going to find me any work anywhere, and I just keep crossing my fingers that something good will turn up. But I think, you know, I think the lodge industry and the float plane is so much about not just who you know, but you know, what your character references as a person. And the people that we've hired there have been very excited to hire because of just they're cool people to hang out with. And, you know, getting a good reputation of just being a nice person and being somebody who's easy to work with, it goes a really, really long way because I don't think we really even – like look at resumes so much anymore. It's not about flight time. It's about how do you fit in hanging out at the lodge with everybody else. So it's such a vast difference than how somebody's hiring on a bigger operation. But I know that's the truth for Pat Goodrich at Island Air X too, and they need very qualified pilots. But for him, they'll have a stack of resumes, and it still comes down to who do you know and what's your reputation and what does somebody else have to say about you that really makes the difference.
Well, that's when I was talking. I actually met up with one of our guys in Bend, and he was going to interview for Hagland, actually, and he asked, what to prep for it. And that, I told him exactly the same thing. I'm like, you're just on all your flight training. They're going to assume you're pretty sharp on all this stuff, and he's a sharp guy, so it would make sense. They really just want to know you're going to get along with everybody. You're going to get along in the pilot house. You're going to get along at work. And that's, I think with the airlines, that's like a key factor too. And I actually think that's one reason airlines want have the college degree requirement. It's not because they think you're going to be smarter. It's just because then everybody's kind of on the same page. That's been my theory. So, Rob, I have another question for you. You said that these big corporations are coming in and kind of buying out the lodges. Are they going to own more than one lodge? In other words, if you want to fly, they might own like three or four different lodges. So you just apply to fly for a corporation?
Well, that's a good question because Bristol Bay Native Corp has absolutely nothing to do with our day-to-day lodge operations. So the hiring of pilots is all in the hands of Guy, our manager, and me as chief pilot for the lodge. But they're sitting there with big checkbooks. So what they've said is we've got $25 million, and we want to come into Bristol Bay and buy up some properties like this. Fish and Lodge means black property, but they've talked about buying Katmai Air. They've talked about some other lodge properties in King Salmon. And so now all of a sudden, you know, we thought we had a problem trying to find one or two other Beaver pilots. We may be needing several more on top of that. And it's so area specific. Not only do you want people with slow plane experience, but you want somebody who's been out in that King Salmon, Iliamna, Bristol Bay area that, you know, knows the terrain, because obviously, as you know, that knowing that local terrain is such a huge safety factor for flying around that all of a sudden, you know, this could be a huge corporation where there are growth opportunities too. So you come in and you have a good personality, you might not necessarily be flying, but you may be managing a lodge also on top of it. So all those little operations, Royal Wolf Lodge you guys were talking about, some of these other little ones, I think that trend going down is that these little lodges are going to be scooped up by these bigger corporations. And Brian Kraft over at Torsum's Lodge, they've been in the bidding, and they might have already agreed to buy Bristol Bay Lodge on Lake Alecnagig. So now you've got, you know, multi-spread out geographically operations branching their arms out. And you get in good one of these places, and maybe you've got some different flying opportunities in the off season for different areas of the state also.
Well, it also might make it easier to actually apply for work, because there's only one person you need to go to. You don't need to, before to fly for a lodge, you kind of had to find the owner or someone who was flying for him and meet them in a bar somewhere and chat with them for a while, and then maybe they'd say, hey, why don't you come fly for us? Maybe it'll get a little easier to figure out who's hiring, when and where, and apply. I don't know about that, but
yeah, it might be. I wonder.
Still there, Rob?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought I might have lost you. And then, of course, you can always propose to your wife by cutting the engine off and burying the ring in the box of tools.
Right, which is another thing you don't get away too well with during 135 work. But hey, Bar 91 is all private clients, so who cares? Who gives a crap?
I have a question. How close did you get to needing to put down the gravel bar?
Oh, for her on that incident?
Yes.
We were over, no, I cut the engine like a couple thousand feet up. We were within gliding distance of a lake. And I was like, pull out the manual. And she's like stressing, pulling out the manual. I'm like, I think I need a fuse. And that was the box with the ring in it. She had no idea that a fuse would do nothing in the airplane, but I pulled it out and I opened the box and there's the ring. So anyway, we landed on the lake, but there was no danger of like having an incident, so to speak.
Mike Moore tells a story very differently.
Is he on this phone call right now?
I don't know. He was at Alyeska at whatever that bar there is in Alyeska. I don't think he was going to make it on.
Okay.
It's Mark.
We need Mike's input on all that stuff.
What's that?
Yeah, we could use Mike's input on all these various categories.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad. I was a little worried to get you, Mike, and Brian on at one time. I didn't know where it would go.
Yeah.
But let's kind of stay sort of on task for what we were supposed to be talking about to some degree. Of course, anybody jump in and ask any questions if they want. And I kind of I was trying to think of through places that might be hiring for the seasonal work. It sounds like some of the lodges might be looking for work. I'll pick your brain on that either in Bend or on through the internet or on the phone, Rob, and see if I can get some more information on that later on this week. But Brian, what do you know about like Fairbanks work? What operators might hire in the summer? You said for right there, you need to wait till someone dies before you can get on. is there any other outfits looking for anyone?
The operators have scaled back a little bit here. Well, certainly during this time of the year. The outfit that bought Warblows, which is they have a tourist side. They call themselves Northwest Tour Company or Air Arctic. They'll hire seasonal people here during the summer. I don't know. I haven't talked to any of them over there, how many they may. But I've heard in the past they'll hire two or three. Wrights may hire, and sometimes they do hire. Well, they do, as a matter of fact, get at least two or three people that have been repeats, go back and forth during the summer only. And I know one of them that has been coming back for years has decided to hang it up, so there will be an opening there for somebody. So they're kind of they'll be kind of a seasonal thing too as well. So there will be at least five or six in the 135 side of things.
I'm sort of on. I've been picking some other brains. I know Everett just ran a ground school for flight engineers. They've been hiring fairly steadily over the last year. It sounds like Kenai operations slowed down a little bit. They're using air tractors quite a bit more, those 802s, and that's a position they often need pilots for. But you're going to need air tractor time.
Yeah, they're adding the MD-88, the longer. DC-9.
Yep.
So those are going through testing and stuff right now, approving tests, whatever they call it. So I would imagine I'm guessing people are moving up to that, where they'll open up positions for people in the 6 and that kind of stuff.
Well, and I think they're looking at some lower 48 stuff too with that MD-88.
Yeah, they have to. They have to branch out. I've heard some stuff about Mexico too, but it's hard to say. Right now.
Yeah, I heard your standard car parts deals, and those they're working out of Texas, and you're flying down to Mexico.
Oh, really?
Kind of how that works. Yeah, and Northern Air Cargo is going to be looking for a couple pilots along the kind of bigger airline deals, more along the rumor line.
Are hiring.
What's that?
Hagelin's doing some big hiring, or will be doing some big hiring soon.
Yeah, Dan, I think you've got a ground school running on the 17th. I don't know if that was in February or March.
Yeah, it's probably February or March because they're having a recurrent ground school right now.
Cool. And just here's a loaded question. Here's a loaded question since you're there. Have you liked it at Hagelin so far?
Oh, yeah. I'm happy here. It's a great opportunity.
Cool.
For those who don't want to do flight instructing, who are 250-hour bare-bones pilots, who don't mind the Alaska bush Western Alaska experience who maybe are not, I mean, who aren't married. I mean that's negotiable, but generally meeting those requirements, that would be a great place to start working, start your career.
Yeah, well, I like Haglund still, and Brian and Rob both flew for Haglund too. It's still one of Jim's just fantastic. I know you guys don't see him as much anymore, but it's always good to know you're working for just a really good guy, and Mike Haglund too. The nice thing about Haglund is they're big enough now that you can start off right seat in the caravan, and if you really like it, like the company, you could actually stay there for a whole career and end up living in Anchorage if you wanted, making pretty good money without working. You know, it'd be kind of a normal commuter job, but that can be a good living, and you're home every night.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's also a really great opportunity because of the 1900 and the Navajos. Just get that twin time and twin PIC, and you can go to the airlines pretty easily, especially Alaska, since Alaska Airlines in-state likes to hire people that have flown here before. So you can go that way, or you're getting that bush, you're getting that Alaska experience, and so you can go fly smaller operations from there too. You can go both ways.
Yeah, I've got a couple of favorite picks of kind of for seasonal work. One would be Transnorthern, which is out of Anchorage, but they've got that DC-3 and the Super DC-3. And I think they do hire load time people for the right seat in the DC-3 as well. And that would just be kind of a fun job. And I've gone by and talked to the owners, and they're super nice. I don't know what they like to work for, but it seems like it'd be a pretty good place. And then Alaska Air Transit, that's out of Merrillfield. I don't know if they're hiring, but they're in one of those kind of niche markets. The owners are super nice. Things are really clean. And it might take more of an effort to get on with them, but I suspect it'd be a good place to work for, and you'd be back in Anchorage every night. So those are kind of some of my picks in there.
Sitting down in the lower 48 and watching on the internet, I've seen ads at Homer, Kodiak, Wings and Juno, Promech and Ketchikan. Somebody else in Ketchikan that just had a P.O. box that couldn't figure out who it was. So there have been some online ads in the last 30 days.
That actually fits. From what I saw when I was in Ketchikan, when did I do that trip? That was, I think it was last year. Maybe it was the year before. I walked the ramp and talked to every operator, every float operator, and I have 140 hours on floats. And damn near every one of them offered me a job. And then I talked to another guy later on in the summer who was fairly desperate for a pilot. And they hire people with extremely low float time. You need some time overall, at least 500, 600, 700 hours just to make minimums. But the way they often run the tours, they'll have the more experienced pilot to go first, then all the other pilots take off behind them. They just fly this big line of airplanes, and they come back, and you land where the guy in front lands. So that's sort of how they get away with hiring lower time people, is they kind of just, you're like the duckling following the duck.
Well, if you fly Misty Fjords, everybody does the same pattern, and thank God for the ADSB, because it can get pretty weird out there.
I bet.
And
Wings of Alaska is a great place to start, I think. I don't know how great they are to work for, but they do hire lower time people, and I think that'd be interesting flying.
Well, the challenge at Wings, I believe, without having any firsthand knowledge, just based on appearances, that they've gone to all turbine otters, I guess, for the float planes. And so, you're not going to get into that equipment without some substantial experience, I don't believe. But they also have the wheel side of the operation. So, you can end up in a caravan or whatever.
And that's what
and
I
know
about
seen,
it. The guy, oh,
I've seen
ahead.
Ads for I've seen ads for both. I've seen a straight float plane ad from them, and I've seen a straight wheel ad from them.
Well, that's more what I was thinking for the people just starting out. Somebody I was emailing early on, when we started the website, he got a job up there. He was a flight instructor in Florida, and he had some time. He had 1,000 hours or so, but he got hired to fly the 207, and they invited him to stay all winter. I think he moved on. I think he's actually going to the Air Force Academy now. But it seemed like they were pretty eager to find someone with 1,000 hours. They were pretty psyched. So I think that the wheel plane time is a good place to start. And I don't know how it would – I don't know how they would move you into the floats. I used to hear that you'd fly the – if you had a float rating, you'd fly the 207 on wheels for half the summer, and then one day they'd just be like – they'd need someone to fly, and they'd be like, hey, you got a float rating? Okay, get it. You got this flight going over here. But it seemed like a good place to start out. I haven't talked to them. I don't know if they'd be a great place to stick around with, but they're probably, you know, fairly normal, I would think.
Well, they've got their own. They've got medallion 5-star and a shield, so they're on top of that sort of culture, I guess.
Yeah, which I'm mixed on some of the medallion stuff. I think some of it's good, and I think that's just my personal opinion. All of it, if it's actually implemented correctly and done correctly, is good, but I think I think companies sometimes do what's required to get the star and then don't necessarily follow through.
Well, it's a top-down culture thing. If the perception of the pilots, the guys out in the trenches, is that management's just giving it lip service, then that's all the pilots will give it. But if I had some involvement with Medallion Foundation at Penn Air through Jerry Dennis when Jerry was still alive, and Penn Air seemed pretty invested in it and found that it was saving them money, and sure, it's not a panacea, it's not gonna take you out of the accident and incident environment entirely, but it certainly makes you think, you know. I mean, they've got wind charts for some of the airports that they didn't have before, and I guess with their pre-flight evaluation of the risk, if they hit a high enough number, they just say, hey, either change the pilot, change the equipment, or cancel the flight. So, which
right,
you were talking about, which you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, and that's where the top end of the company has to be serious about it. Otherwise, the pilots just make the numbers work out so they can fly. Or they arrange they arrange it so that you really can't ever be in the high numbers.
Yeah.
So I think Medallion's a good idea, but you're right. It needs to be, the management needs to be invested in it for it to be effective. And I think the FAA's actually, that's part of the stuff that's coming as an accident. They're going to be mandating more of this. You know, a lot of that just comes down to operational control, a lot of the Medallion stuff. And it was, I think you're going to see more of it implemented. So it'll be interesting.
There was a point in time where some of the school systems were saying that, you know, we don't want the teachers flying on anybody unless they're involved with the Medallion CFIT, or, you know, they were starting to put some controls in place that were external rather than internal, and I wondered whether that ever went anywhere.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about that. I think the big thing that drove Medallion, and this is actually telling that Medallion was working, is the insurance company. You got an insurance break if you were, you know, if you were invested in Medallion. And insurance companies just look at numbers. So, I mean, they're looking at it, and if you were doing the Medallion program, I can pull up discrepancies, but overall, the companies that were invested in Medallion must have had a lower accident rate, or insurance companies would not have given them a break. So, I mean, all they care about is the bottom line. And
that's the actuary's working probabilities.
Yeah, yeah. But what about you, Brian? Have you seen any, do you think Medallion is ineffective, or is it?
Well, the interesting question came up a little earlier. I can't remember who had asked that. Was asked if Haglund's was a member of Medallion. And I know, well, let me, if somebody, again, going back to this buy-in on ADS-B, if somebody totally buys into the Medallion program, it's going to be very effective. But if it's just, I got to be careful here, bought into just for the stars and the shield, but isn't practiced, then it isn't going to work. So it's really on the operator. To me, it seems like it's really on the operator, ultimately, to make these things work. Now, that being said, the folks that are heavily involved in Medallion and making it happen, is it the operator that's doing it or is it Medallion that's doing it? Did Medallion fix them and make them better? And that's the question I have to ask. So I don't have a real solid opinion one way or the other. Now, in light of Haglund's being in the Medallion program and then having these problems that they had over the last this last year was pretty rough on them. And I have to qualify this, because I'm an old-time Haglund guy, and that's where I cut my teeth, really. It pains me to see them go through it. I feel a personal loss there every time something happens. And if they're doing the Medallion program, then that's something that says that it isn't working. But was it Medallion or was it the operator? And that's a big question that needs to be answered before you can really answer that question wholly.
But I think one of the interesting things is, we talked about this in December, Brian, there used to be a lot of don't do this, wink, wink. Actually, there wasn't even a don't do this. It was just go. But then it became don't do this, wink, wink. In other words, still go. We just don't want to hear about it. And,
right.
You know, I know from talking to Jim, and I know Jason Wilson, and this is straight to Haglund, they didn't want this stuff occurring anymore. They just... You could argue they weren't effective in making it not happen. So somewhere there was a breakdown in getting down to the bases. And this is exactly what we talked about in December. And I'm probably not 100% right, and a lot of people would probably really be pissed at me about this, but I think the problem was a lot of, it was more experienced pilots who were used to doing it the old way, and they were still seeing the wink, wink when the wink really wasn't there anymore. I think that was probably part of the problem. So as pilots start accepting that this is just the way it's going to happen, you'll get less of the, it's a quarter mile. Ah, shit, we can get in that. You're going to get less of that.
Go take a look. There's no time for that anymore.
Yeah, it costs companies a lot more money every time they get plane crashes.
You don't have the equipment, and you have the loss of goodwill with your customers, too.
Yeah, and the loss of goodwill, I saw that in Barrow when we had the crash with Haglund in the 90s. We got it back pretty quick because Smythe was, people liked Smythe less than they liked us. But, you kill people in a community, a small community, and they aren't really happy with you. and rightly so. They've got a good point.
Hey, Aiden.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I've got to go. I've got to go get my daughter, but I wanted to say I'm going to fly Niner 4 Mike with Paul on Wednesday, so wish me luck.
Oh, yeah, good luck. Say hi to Paul, too, and, enjoy the one. That's going to be fun.
Yeah, it was nice chatting with you all, and back to the changing face of aviation. I think the IFR culture is kind of making things a little more risky here in Talkeetna. You know those, 11,000-foot and below cloud top days?
That's actually, I didn't think about that. That's a good point.
Yeah, it's interesting that the whole trickle-down culture is making things a little more riskier, a little more edgier here. It's just, so cloud tops are 11,000 feet and below, and a Navajo goes up and says, there's no icing, and so all the otters go up, and they have the composite plan where they go up on, they file, go up, and then go into the Class Alpha airspace around Denali, and then cancel IFR and land on the glacier and then pick up IFR again and go back to Talkeetna. It's nuts. It's like a bush plane, IFR, everything flight.
I hear exactly what you're saying about that. And if you need to run, you can run. I'll talk about that a little bit more, but I know exactly what you're saying.
I just had a pilot of mine, friends, he just came back from a flight, they're up on supplemental oxygen up there. Came down, landed on the glacier, picked up IFR, came back to Talkeetna, direct via Savco, Talkeetna to Talkeetna. Anyway, he was like, gosh, you know what? That was just an everything flight.
it could be fun for the pilots, but I think most pilots would rather just keep it VFR in Talkeetna.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what I had to say, and thank you guys so much for having me here.
Yeah, thanks for joining in. We'll see you in Denali.
Yes, you in Denali. Nice to meet you all.
Bye-bye. What Leanne was saying, and this is again how it gets interesting, how sometimes when companies want to be more official and more correct or use the rules to their advantage, and in Talkeetna you can, you know, have an 800-foot ceiling or a 1,000-foot ceiling, it could actually be pretty good, but you can't get to the Alaska Range VFR, in other words, flying up the glaciers like we normally do. So the trend, and the Navajo has done this for a while, but the single engine turbine IFR rule is what's changed things. They'll file IFR and get above the clouds and then cancel, and you can go above 18,000 as long as you're within a certain distance of Denali, of the land. So they'll file IFR, get above the cloud, go in and land up on the mountain, up on the glacier, do their tour, and then they fly back down, pick up an IFR plan, and come back in. I'm not actually sure there's anything wrong with that, except I think most of the pilots aren't that experienced IFR, so it gets more exciting for them than it needs to be. And then I think the concern with the single engines is they're a way to actually glide down without going back into the clouds. So I think that's kind of what she was referring to. So it's interesting how all this kind of, and ADS-B, I don't know what that'll do with that either. But the GPS definitely affects it, and people are using iPads and Talkeetna quite a bit, which is a good way to do it. So, anyone have anything else?
No, I didn't have anything else, Aiden.
Cool. Rob, you still there?
Rob fell asleep.
I think I called him up at 6:30 tonight. You know, it was 7:30 his time, and I mean, he's already had a glass of wine, so he might have.
Easy now. I'm still there. It took me a while to pull it off my mute button because I don't want to be drooling all over the phone and have you hear that noise.
Well, Rob, I was going to say, I'll call you up later on, and I'm curious about the lodge stuff there a little bit. And, if you make it back to Bend, I'll see you in Bend.
Absolutely, and I'm happy to give you any more details with a clean mind later on if anybody's really interested. But really, that's the position I'm in the last couple of years, is having a hard time finding the qualified float plane pilots. And it's not so much the time on board. It's like, I'd love to get, you with 200 hours of floats and Mike Moore and Brian Weckworth, these people that we know in the past that are great people. It doesn't take much float plane experience to get a good job. That's the key thing. You have to just be a decent pilot, and then you can kind of learn the rest from there on. So in our lodge situations, we could be, instead of looking for one pilot, looking for two or three or four in the years down the road. So I don't know. I think that float plane part of it is a real growth portion of this industry, perhaps. And once you get in, once you get established in that little niche, it's really quite good pay.
And it's also, it sounds like it's a good way if you want to do seasonal or contract type work.
Yeah, I mean, that's my worry. It's like, am I qualified for anything else? How do I get back into the IFR world? What if I want to do a PC-12? How do I establish that other kind of thing? Because I feel like I'm kind of boxed into a little situation. But it's kind of the golden handcuffs. I'm never going to leave Mission Lodge because as long as they're up and running, I've got almost a great year-round salary just working for 3.5 months. So as long as you if you're the type of person can keep expanding your skills and keep opportunities open and combine it with something else, then it's almost can make for a great career.
Yeah, well, I remember, this is Mike in Seattle, I remember when Aiden and I worked together at Kenmore Air here back in the 90s, there were guys working there who were airline pilots, and then, in their time off would just fly during the summer part-time for Kenmore, and that was, for them, it was almost like they were getting paid to just have fun screwing around in a float plane.
Yeah, I think that's about right. We'll see what happens. That's kind of what I saw in Ketchikan too, is the same idea that, and in fact, the ProMec chief pilot told me straight up, he said, you've got plenty of time. He's like, I can teach you how to fly the float plane. And Gowie at Kenmore said the same thing. He said, yeah, we'd like more time, but we can make it work. So, And Rob, I thought of the way, if you want to get into a PC-12, you just go hit up Life Flight there in Bend, and you can be home every night.
Yeah, but you know what? Honestly, when I talked to those guys about it, he said, well, really, the experience I'd like you to have is, you know, getting on with, like, Ameriflight, flying those cargo runs in the Navajos over the Cascades and the icing in the winter. So, you know, almost that experience I had up in Alaska back, you know, with St. Mary's and doing all that stuff in the 402, it's not really standing out on my resume. I don't know if it's just too far in the distance or a different area, but they kind of want that hardcore IFR over the mountains in the northwest area to be qualified for that job. So I don't think he was very really even interested in me.
Yeah, you just have to keep talking to him and go have beer with him or something. I mean, it's all, you know, how well you know somebody. But they're owned by a big corporation, but you have to talk to a lot of people in Bend about them, and they have a lot of local control over who they hire.
Okay.
So my suspicion is if you were really interested and sat down and schmoozed them and took them skiing, you'd end up with a job.
Well, I think that, you know, that's the other problem is being a seasonal pilot, and I don't want to lie about my situation. So when I go in, I know I'm going back to work in Alaska the next summer, and I tell, you know, Carl Natter was the chief pilot, maybe he's still there, and Ben, and I'm saying, no, that's my gig. Are you guys interested in hiring somebody for the winter? And he says, no, not really. We kind of want somebody who's committing to year-round.
Yeah, that's. I had the same thing. There's an air ambulance in Bishop, and I just talked to the guy, the new chief pilot. He was awesome. It's a company I've always been interested in, but a few years ago I talked to the chief pilot about it, and, you know, I was living in my truck, and I was climbing, and, you know, I showed up, and he's like, you know, I'm living in my truck, but I'd really like to settle down. He was like, yeah, you know, there are a lot of people living in their trucks in Bishop. He was just like, yeah, you know, we're kind of interested, but we don't want someone who hasn't settled down yet. It's like, when you're here and living in Bishop, talk to me. Don't tell me you're waiting to get the job to settle down. And that hit home. I was like, oh, yeah, I guess I should have showered this morning.
Yeah, it says something. I mean, you think they're desperate for pilots, but apparently they're really not, because obviously they can make those kind of standards judgments.
Well, they don't want
a
pilot who's not going to fit in or leave. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Matt. So there's quite a few seasonal pilots that come up here. I haven't really come in contact with a lot of them, but what do they normally do on their off seasons? Is there a typical genre of jobs they do, or is it just odd jobs? They don't work, travel? I mean, I can think of a lot of things that I could do with my time if I didn't have work 3/4 of the year, but what's the standard?
Well,
yeah,
I know Rob was a ski instructor 1 year.
Well, that's a great question, because you kind of have to piece together whatever life you want to make of it. One of our pilots, he's sailing a sailboat down through Southeast, and he's probably off to the Caribbean by now, for all I know. Another guy is kind of working in the mechanic shop in Juneau, doesn't really want to fly much in the winter, so he's just wrenching it. So it does leave the opportunity for doing all kinds of other things, or opening up your own business, or living somewhere else. So it can be a double-edged sword. You can say, well, it screws me out of getting a year, you know, a good year-round aviation job. But then again, you have those winters to explore different options and maybe develop a second career or a backup to aviation.
Right.
I think
I think that's great.
I think finances factor in heavy. If you need to make money year-round and you can't make it through on what you make in the summer, then obviously you need another job. But if you can live cheap, it's a pretty good lifestyle. But yeah, you get, you know, nine months a year.
You know, that's where the lodge thing makes the whole difference in the world, because, you know, are you making any tips in 135? Not likely. The salaries are less. You know, when you go to the lodge work, all of a sudden room and board is paid for. I don't spend any money during the whole summer. And you're making tips, you're making a good salary, so you're banking away all of that, and then you just budget for the winter to get through, and then any money you make, ski instructing or whatever else you're doing, is almost a bonus on top of that. Plus, I'm not afraid to take Alaska unemployment also, and that was running up like $7,000 a year in the winter, so I could ski instruct and make unemployment at the same time.
Yeah, I remember meeting up in the beer when you were ski instructing. You did that just for the ski pass.
Yeah. So
I'm curious about that. How does that work with seasonal work and unemployment like that for these companies?
you're automatically qualified for it. And I think the unemployment, you know, sends something to the company that says, hey, something comes out of the company's pocket. And it may have been a black mark when you had, you know, Dale DePriest, single owner of the lodge, but he never even mentioned it to me. I'm like, dude, if I can't find winter work, I'm going to apply for unemployment. I have my resume out there to try to find a flying job, but if I don't get anything that's of quality, I'm doing unemployment. They can't really do anything about it. And Bristol Bay Native Corp, now that they own it, they don't say a word about it. It's a nothing. It's not an issue at all.
Well, and this year you've got work all winter in Scottsdale flying the
right. So
airplane.
Now you got to, well, dang it. Really, so I'm not doing the unemployment this year. But who knows? I'm always looking for something else. I'm always trying to look outside of aviation also and go, well, man, what if something happens to me or my vision or something? Who knows? What else am I capable of doing outside of flying this little float plane?
Yeah, that doesn't hurt. I'm always, I don't know what I'm looking for. I like having my apartment now. It's great. I'm 100 feet from the climbing gym.
Yeah.
Yeah. I may never get in my truck again. any other questions, Mike or Matt?
I've got to run, and it's been a pleasure listening to everybody, and I think this was a good experiment.
Cool.
Yeah,
thanks.
And
well,
I think, we'll do other topics. I think Africa is a great one. And, there's lots of others on our list.
There's a ton of them. I'd actually like to talk to you about some of what you've flown, too. So I'll be in touch with you at some point just to, give me, I'm not real prompt on things, but I'll get around to it. But it sounds like you've had a pretty cool career.
Oh, I've had way more fun than you're supposed to have.
That's usually a good career right there.
Hey, thanks, guys. I got to run.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Take care.
Yep. Matt, how's it going?
Oh, it's going good. Just spending some time up here in Catsview, halfway through the shift.
How long have you been flying for them, Matt?
Anywhere.
I started working for them as a pilot in November, so it's kind of a new journey here. I was a mechanic for them in Nome for about a year and a half while I was getting my ratings.
COTS is a good base.
Yeah.
I'm
thinking that would be a good backup plan, and mechanicing isn't a terrible job. But doing something outside of aviation that, uses other skill sets or interests would be cool. And so that's why the seasonal work kind of is interesting, working in the summers. Granted, you don't get to have summers off to do stuff that's fun, but if you put your off season in a warm climate, that wouldn't be too bad.
Yeah, they're well in Talkeetna. Leanne didn't go. I didn't go too much with her, but all those air taxis. There are five airlines that have the concession to fly the mountain. They're the flight schools, but they're not going to pay as much. But the air taxis that have the concession, first year you won't do so well, but if you stick around with them, you can do pretty well with them, and it's pretty fun work. And they like mechanics usually. So you'd have options of wrenching in the winter as well. You wouldn't have to do it full-time, but I know, Paul's always rebuilding planes. Danielle's full-time as a mechanic. And that's how he's
fantastic. Yeah, I've gone down there to talk to those guys, and they seem to like where they work, and they like to live. They like living where they're at, so that's definitely on the radar scope. But the question is, how do you get that tailwheel time? They want, like, 500 hours of tailwheel time. And it's hard to get that unless you flight instruct. So maybe the answer is to go get a flight instructing rating and teach tailwheel for a while.
Or take that money and buy a plane. You can pick up a cheap champ as a mechanic. That's actually even more doable. A lot of the pilots at PAT have their own airplane, and that's unusual for Talkeetna PAT. K2, the pilots aren't going to have. There's some of the pilots have planes, but not as many. You could also start out at one of the other outfits. I know that I think it's Fly Denali has those turbine otters, but they've certainly hired people fairly low time without much tailwheel time. And Roderick at PAT would probably have you do some wrenching, and then you know you'd move into the fly. They're not scared of low time people.
I think it's a lot of like if they know you, they start to work with you, see your personality and your character, and see if they're willing. And if they like what they see, they'll be willing to invest into training you or the financial obligation of getting you on the insurance at low time or whatever it takes to get you trained up to fly for them.
Yeah, so I mean, you heard Rob say it, and I've said it a lot to you. They want people who are going to fit into the program and get along with everyone much more than they want flight time. And I think that's true almost across the board. The flight time gets you an interview, but that's about it. And if you can walk in there with low time and talk to them, you can overcome lower flight time. And you know, if you stick it out in cost or NOM for a year or two, you're going to have plenty of flight time. So
yeah.
Yeah, so Matt, before you were in Alaska, where were you?
I grew up in North Idaho, near Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, Spokane Coeur d'Alene area.
Okay.
And so did my flight training north of Spokane, and did my A&P training in Spokane. Then came out to Alaska for an A&P job, and I knew I always wanted to fly. Mm-hmm. I got my A&P so I could have that for possible humanitarian, missionary flying. A lot of those organizations require you to have an A&P. So that was that was the big reason, one of the big reasons. The other reason was to help finance flying with an aviation-related career or skill set.
Being an A&P it's never going to hurt you. Although Mark Johnson did tear up his A&P license at one point. There was still paper then. He was so tired of people asking for him to wrench. You know, he was never flying. They're always like, well, we need a mechanic more than a pilot.
Mark Johnson probably tore up his pilot's license, though.
Now that he's out of the Hagland,
That's right. I forgot you knew Mark Johnson there, Rob, as well. I saw him. I saw him, you know, a couple months ago at my lab when I was in St. Mary's there. He was sad about Terry, but doing well. That was cool. He finally bought his boat. He's got a boat in Portland.
Is the CIA still chasing him?
You know, he doesn't talk about it as much anymore, so I'm guessing he's free and clear now.
Awesome.
All right, I need to probably get along and do some stuff too, like go to bed.
As you guys know, those of you who know Aiden, you know he's like a little puppy. He's like full of energy, and then all of a sudden he just crashes.
I had coffee before the phone call so I could catch up. I had a lot of workouts to do today. Cool, but Rob, I'll find you somewhere somehow. You should get back to Bend, and I'll see you there. And, yeah, Matt, stay in touch. I'm always curious what's going on out there. It sounds like I won't be out there for a while. Say hi to Clint and all the boys and girls in Nome there if you see them.
Yeah, you haven't been in Nome too much lately, but when I see them, I'll say hi.
Cool, and I'm jealous. Kotz is truly one of my favorite places to fly out of anywhere. Maybe I just always had a good crew I was working with there. So if you see Eric C., tell him hi too.
Well, I hear him on the radio all the time, man. He's flying the heck out of that 206, and he's got a Cub now.
Yeah, well, tell him hi. Tell him if he needs a pilot, I'll come up. I'd drop out anything to go fly with fly for Eric. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
It would be cool. All right, everybody have a good night. We'll talk to everyone
later. Hey, Aiden.
All right, good night.
Yeah. Who's that?
Hey, I know you got to go to bed. Quick question. This is Joe Rosman. I'm getting ready to start flight school with Land and Sea in about 10 days. And part 61 or 141. I'm trying to set myself up for, you know, the best options out there when I complete all this. What would you what would you recommend?
That's a, in terms of when
million
you complete
dollar question?
It, yeah, what went to you, they're very different programs. Personally, I think it's not going to make much difference at all immediately out of flight school.
Okay.
I just was down talking to a actually the Central Oregon Community College, and they've got a great aviation program down there. They're 141. And he said one reason to go 141 is easier to get financing.
Okay.
And, like, they've got a bunch of grants and loans you can get, and that's a big reason to 141. On paper, you can get it done quicker, but that's not really – that doesn't usually happen that way.
Okay.
If you get it, if you're going to get a degree out of it, even just a two-year degree, it might be worth doing 141. It might cost a little bit more, but if you, even if you don't want to go to the airlines now, you may sometime in the future, and you can finish a four-year degree online if you don't have one, and that's usually a requirement
right.
for the airlines. Other than that, I really don't think it's much different.
Right. As far as the ERA co-pilot program, how hard is that to get into, and would 61 or 141 be advantageous in that
program?
Won't
matter at all. And Matt may know more about that, but I don't think they don't care what type of flight school you went to. And
okay.
Oh, they love pilots that went to school in Anchorage. The chief pilot goes trolling around there sometimes to see if – see if anybody is interested or ready to go fly for them. They're eager to hire pilots with 250 hours. So get your commercial, and even before you have your commercial, go start meeting chief pilot and get your name out there. And that's what I did. I didn't have my commercial yet, and I just was keeping in touch with them. And they're like, yeah, just let us know. Keep us in the loop. And when I had it, I was in, the next ground school.
Outstanding. That gives me goosebumps. That's encouraging.
Yeah, no, and that's actually so many – Matt hit the nail on the head.
Right.
I've talked to so many pilots who've just gotten their commercial ratings and instructor ratings. They haven't looked for a job yet because they've been so focused on getting their ratings. I would even say go talk to Jason at Hagelin. You know, go talk to a couple operators if you're in Anchorage. I still like that Transnorthern, but they're seasonal. And ask Jason if it would matter. You know, say, hey, I'm looking at, you know, getting into flying. I'd really like to fly for you guys. Would you rather, you know, part 61 or part 141 flight school? Do you have a preference? And then go back
right.
6 months later when you get your private and say, I just got my private. I'm still psyched to work for you guys. And I can just about guarantee you, you'll have a job as soon as your commercial is complete.
Outstanding.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and I was just thinking that, you know, I know people and you know people who have had amazing aviation careers because they've, quote, had connections. I know somebody who, as a kid, grew up with parents who owned an airport out on the Olympic Peninsula here. And because of that, he met all sorts of pilots and got to fly all sorts of planes even before he was old enough to get a license. And he's flown for airlines and cargo operations and Kenmore Air Express and all this stuff. And he's like 22 years old. But what I realized hearing all this is you can make yourself a person who has connections. You know, you don't have to be born into it. And what I keep hearing from all these people is, you know, if you network and just start meeting people, even before you have a private pilot's license, you will have connections. And you don't have
right.
to let luck do it. You can just go out there and be friendly and meet people.
Well, I think that's exactly how you do. I mean, that's you might be lucky and be born in the right place, but the odds are you need to, you know, go drum up your own connections. And are you in Anchorage now?
No, I'm actually calling from Afghanistan. I'm an airport firefighter out here doing
wow.
contract work, and I'm going on my R&R, visiting family. I'm partly from Alaska, and so on my next R&R, I'm going to be starting flight school.
Cool. Yeah, that's if you can do it in Anchorage and talk to people, you will be on it. you can friend George Wilkinson. He just got hired by ERA. He's still got ground school to do. You know, it's not a done deal, but I'm pretty sure he's going to be in. And same thing, he had 300 hours and did a flight school in Bend, and he went through a 141 program.
Okay.
Are you're doing contract work? You're not in the military?
I'm prior military, but no, I've been out working in Afghanistan for about 8 years now as on Bagram Air Base as an airport firefighter.
Cool. I drove right by there a few months ago.
Yeah, I saw your post that you were out here tooling around.
Yeah, we drove by. There was some attack going on right near the Air Force base, and I was with some French Special Forces guy. He was plainclothes, and he got on the radio, and he's like, that's miles away from us. We're okay. Keep driving.
you guys saw the video of that 747 that went down, right?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, I was on duty that day and went on that accident.
Oh, man. Oh, I heard the last word on the radio where the on flight recorder were load shift. That's what it looks like. I don't know if that's true.
The connection's breaking up, so I'm not able to hear you guys.
Yeah, at any rate, send me any questions you have on the network, and I'll give you some more ideas. But if you have the GI Bill, they'll pay for just about everything, depending on which GI Bill you have.
And I do. And I appreciate it. I would like to hit you up on the network, and I have a few more questions, but I'm still got a little ways to go, so I have plenty of time to answer, figure this all out. So, hey, I appreciate it. And I want to thank you and Mike. I want to thank you guys. I mean, it's really been a kind of an inspiration for me finding your website and listening to all your interviews and all that. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, cool.
Thank you.
I'll second that. Friend George Wilkinson, too. He's prior military. He had a really interesting military career, and he's just gone through the 141 program with the GI Bill. He's an awesome guy. You guys would get along well now. You can ask him some questions, too. He might have more pertinent stuff than I do.
Okay, cool. I appreciate it. And get some
sleep. Yeah, you too. Good luck over there. Be careful. Yeah.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm going to buy you a beer one of these days once I get my license.
All right, we'll see you in Anchorage or somewhere.
All right. Yep. Sounds good. Thanks,
all right,
guys.
All right.
Thanks. Have a good one. All right.
All right. We'll see you. Have a good one.
You too. And Rob, if you're still on there, I'll talk to you later.